This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Oh, doing pretty good. So it looks like your microphone's working fantastic. That's great. Love it.
Good here.
All right. So, Dr. Lyle, last week I've gotten a couple of comments already about how wonderful people enjoyed the ego trap that you explained in the show last week. And so today we are now going to take some questions through email and live callers mm-hmm. who have questions about the ego trap for their own particular situations. So if there's any live callers that have a question about this, you can call us live at 657-383-0751. So we have a caller on hold already. We're going to take one question from the email, and then we're going to mm-hmm. speak with Nicola in just a bit. So Dr. Lyle, here we go.
All right.
You ready?
Yep.
Sure as you're born?
Yeah.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, I've been struggling at university for years. I just can't get myself to study. I fall asleep at lectures immediately, and then I get the urge to jump up when I sit down to read. And literally every few seconds while studying, my brain will throw up suggestions of what else I could be doing. I feel a lot of anxiety when confronting this issue. I've tried to explain to my parents what the ego trap is, and I've even gone so far as suggesting that they should stop paying for my stuff and ask for rent or throw me out, as you've suggested. But they wanted to hear none of that. Could you suggest any solutions?
This is great. What kind of a young person is this? This is hilarious. Let's see now. First of all, I think they're Canadian or European because we don't say university here in the U.S. We say the university, or we say what university it is, so we can immediately suspect that they're from a foreign land. The falling asleep in lectures. Remember, you can't make a human being fall asleep unless it's sleep deprived. So therefore, it's possible that this person might be staying up a little too late playing video games in that dorm room. So that could be an issue. Now, obviously, I don't know the exact nature of this person's situation, how poorly they're doing, how long they've been in the school, and how ludicrous this whole university investment is at this point and what they're studying. However, as a general rule, I would do exactly as this young person suggests. I would tell the parents to give them a knapsack and a $20 bill. So that they essentially they should quit school and get a job and start supporting themselves, just like a normal animal anywhere in nature does the same thing. If you're a baboon, your mom gives you, $20 in a suitcase and says, get lost. I'm not supporting you anymore. Okay. And so this is, remember that motivation is simply a derivative of a computation of cost-benefit analysis across all of your opportunity costs, relationships between you and the environment as best you understand them. So if it turns out that if your best CB is to sit around and do nothing and, sort of go through university six units a year, like a caterpillar while you live in mom and dad's beautiful 2,800 square foot house, and you've got the whole downstairs now, and your sister's gone, and you know she has a job and's married, so you're the last one there, and you're the apple of your mother's eye, and so they just keep hoping that something's gonna happen. So obviously, you would be better off almost under any other circumstances. So this is what I call the animal in the zoo problem, that animals in a zoo sit around and don't do anything, and they're not very happy. And so if you let them out of the zoo, it's scary, of course, and a lot of them could not make it in the wild, so we wouldn't do that to them. But it would be much better if we put them in a situation where they had a little bit of challenge and they had to do something. So when they hide the bear's food, the bears are happier in zoos. They don't do much of that because the bears figure it out pretty quickly. So this isn't just with this young person's situation. It's many people's situations. This is the problem of an heiress that doesn't have to do anything. And so now she sort of gets into nothing but trouble and a bunch of wastrel-level activity. This is husbands and wives in mediocre relationships, but they're in cushy financial limited circumstances, so it's pretty easy where they are, but it would be difficult if they actually struck out independently and had to support themselves or enhance their lifestyle. You know, it's a little too tough on their own, so they just soon stay together and not be very happy. That's another animal in the zoo situation. Quite frankly, this young person would be, do we know if it's a young man or a young woman?
I'm assuming it's a young man, but that is just based on my own biases.
let's suppose that it is. In that case, he's better off being lost on a desert island. And if it turns out if Ginger or Marianne is there with him, he'll figure out what to do. He'll be doing heroic things in no time. And financial desert island will cause the same thing. So if suddenly an individual has to hustle, they'll immediately be making more of their potential. And there'll be an edge to life that isn't there when you're in a zoo. And once you do that for a while and find out how difficult it is to actually dig an honest dollar out of the world, which it is surprisingly difficult to do that, then a little light goes on in your head as you start figuring out if you were gifted an above average mind, you start figuring out that maybe it's a good idea to figure out how other people have used their above average minds in order to make more of those dollars. And so then suddenly we're back at university with some motivation to study. So yeah, what we've got is the animal in a zoo problem, and the young man's or woman's answer to the problem is accurate. The parents should show them the door kindly and pleasantly. And if they won't show you the door, you can do it for yourself. There's nothing to stop you from taking a deep breath, dropping out of school at the end of this semester or quarter or whatever it is, and getting yourself a job at Starbucks and seeing just what it takes to make $12 an hour. All right.
Fantastic. So this actually isn't an ego trap question. My mistake. But it's useful to know.
Mm-hmm.
It's useful to know. I was reading a study that was published in November of last year in a journal called The Frontiers in Psychology. It's a personality and social psychology journal. And this was a study where they took a daily diary of several dozen employees. And what they determined first was whether or not people had high natural self-control or low natural self-control. And it turns out that when these people reported that they had low sleep quality, the people with high self-control, so genetic higher self-control, it really didn't matter about their performance. But the people who had low self-control, when they had low sleep quality, it affected their performance significantly. So it's useful to know for people that if you happen to have lower than average self-control, or at least lower self-control, then you got to get some good sleep. Ideally, we'd want good sleep for everybody, but in these types of more so.
Right. And Nathan, just to translate what self-control means, just substitute the word conscientiousness.
Hmm.
Yeah. that'll help clear up what that means. So the authors didn't quite do their homework. That's okay. So that's what they were studying. They were studying conscientiousness, and they found an interesting little effect there that if you're already a flake and then you're short of sleep, then you're completely worthless, which of course makes a lot of sense. All right.
All right. Fantastic. Well, let's take our caller. Okay. Nicola from Virginia. Nicola, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Lyle. I'm a 21-year-old female, about 5'7", and about 155 pounds, and I believe that I'm holding on to my extra weight due to a highly conditioned cramp circuit, but I also think that I'm in an ego trap with regards to weight loss. So my question is, how does one entrap themselves, and is it possible for the person enforcing the ego trap to be able to help support you and feel useful?
I'm not sure. You just lost me a little bit on the last part, but let's just sort of walk through the problems that you're facing, and for a few minutes, and let's see if we can give you some help. Okay. So,
sure.
It would look to me like at 5'7", 155, that maybe do you know enough about your history to know where you would be really comfortable and happy with yourself weight wise?
3 years ago, I was dancing a lot, and so I was like 120 pounds, and then I kind of struggled with emotional eating and went to college, which made me gain a bunch of weight, and I've already lost 15 pounds, but I'm still, ways away from where I was when I'm dancing, and I'm not necessarily hoping to get all the way back down there, but maybe in like the mid-120s.
Okay. Now I sort of understand what you're thinking. And so when you were 18, so at 5'7", 120, what were things like, say, when you were 13, 14, 15, 16, 17? Is this all pretty consistent? In other words, you were slender and kind of tall and slender?
Yeah, I was like, when I was 13, I was probably like 110, and then grew as I got older.
Got it. Okay. So what we're seeing here is that in about 3 years, between about 18 and 21 or so, you gained 50 pounds is what happened.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a gigantic amount of weight gain in a very small time period. So just to kind of clear things up, there's no emotional issue that's going to do that. Okay, this is you underwent a radical dietary change here. So the did this pretty well coincide with you leaving home and going to college and eating from a different table?
Pretty well, yes. Yeah. At home, I eat a very healthy, whole food, plant based, SOS, all that stuff. But in college, it's very different.
Got it. Okay. So you go to college and now you're eating off the college smorgasbord, and we wind up with really spectacular weight gain. And what we're seeing also is the genetics, like any medications or anything else that you were taking at the time, anybody put you on antidepressants or anything like that?
No. But okay. I was binging a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So so what we have here is what we discovered with you, Nicola, is we discovered that you've got the genes to be significantly overweight, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know that when you were 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. We didn't know it. And so you were eating a very healthy diet at home that was, had a lot of natural food in it. So the overall calorie density of the diet was, within target range for our species. And so when you went away to school, you went above that target range for the species. And as a result, we discovered that you're what we're going to call an easy keeper. That's a name they have for horses, that when you start feeding them richer food, they start to put on weight. Okay. So mm-hmm. a lot of racehorses, they have to regulate their intake very carefully because if they don't, they'll put on weight and now they're not as fast. And so the so for yourself, what the real fundamental issue here is there can be some complicated other things that we could throw in the notion of a conditioned cram and the ego trap. We could talk in those kind of details, but the most fundamental issue here that we see is the pleasure trap. So what's actually happening here is that, that's really the fundamental issue.
So now I'm actually back at home. So I am eating back on that whole food plant-based thing. Mm-hmm. And that's how I was able to lose 15 pounds. But the reason that I'm taking time off is because last year my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreas cancer. So I'm going to take care of her. And so she's the one who's also like pressuring me to lose weight, which is why I believe I'm in the ego trap, because now it's a new sense of urgency for her that I should be as healthy as I can be, because I do, like, cancer is genetic in our family. Like, many people have cancer in my family. So that's why I think it's a cram circuit where I'm eating healthy food, but then continuing to eat the Ezekiel bread and peanut butter that you talk about. So, and I'm also hoping to find a way to help her feel useful in helping me, because at the moment she doesn't feel very useful.
Right. Yeah. So you've got a lot going on here. And so I would say that, that obviously your mom's situation and her emotional state and the state of her life, that's got to be, I assume that's very much primary for you as you sort of look over everything. So are you the only kid that's home, or are there other kids, or what's happening?
I'm an only child, yeah.
You're an only child, okay. And is your dad around?
My stepdad is, yes.
Stepdad, okay. So you've got a stepdad, and then your mother is, so your mother's in obviously a very scary, health situation, and so is she feeling so she's sort of feeling a sense of urgency to try to guide you in a way that will lower your risk of going down the same road. Is that part of what's happening?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So one thing that we have is we actually have a problem that your mom has a misunderstanding of reality. So you eating peanut butter on Ezekiel bread is not increasing your likelihood of getting cancer. And you being 40 or 50 pounds overweight, which you're no longer, but you were maybe, you might naturally be 130 pounds at this point. In other words, you're not as young as you were at 18. And so it's very possible your natural genetics would lead you a little higher than 120. That's pretty thin for 5'7". Mm-hmm. So maybe now that maybe you're 25 pounds overweight, and so maybe you're, 15% overweight or something. But your mother, obviously, did your mother introduce you to sort of the whole foods, plant-based arena?
I actually introduced her, but she got really into it. So, yes, she educated me.
Mm-hmm. Right. How long has she been into it?
Probably 3 or 4 years.
Okay. So was this prior to her diagnosis?
Yes, she was diagnosed just this last year.
My goodness. Okay. So this is... obviously a tremendous shock and disappointment and a real, a tremendous problem to be grappling with. And so your mom, is she doing a good job on her own diet?
Yes, I make all of her food and she's very healthy.
Fantastic. Okay, so she's giving herself every chance to try to beat this thing into a stalemate. which is, I'm sure, possible. And so we hope for the best and give her all the best wishes we can. But one of the things that we want to do is sort of to reduce her worry. And one of the things that might be useful for her to know is to know that you know, if a person is overweight, that's not a substantial influence on their cancer risk at all.
Mm-hmm.
So your mom is, it might be useful for her to know that's a misconception. And so how to tell her this, or how you might want to tell her this, you could say that you've talked to me. Does she know who I am?
I tell her about your podcast all the time. Yes.
Okay. Does she know sort of the four horsemen, Campbell, McDougall, Ornish, Esselstyn? Does she know those people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what has been discovered is that there's going to be a relationship between the animal food in somebody's diet and cancer. That relationship is modest, but it's there. But there's no relationship independent of that showing that excess weight on anybody's body is going to influence their likelihood of getting cancer. Okay. So you can let her know that you spoke with me, and you can tell her that I'm actually quite tight with Colin Campbell, and I've co-authored science with him. And so I'm well aware of his research, and that there is no concern at all over the fact that your weight is higher than you would like it to be, but that's not an influence on cancer. Okay. So really what it is that, so really she can take that off of her plate, so to speak. And so the real issue is just you, trying to battle the pleasure trap. Okay. And we've now discovered that the pleasure trap for you, like for everyone, it's a very difficult problem to manage, but secondarily, we found out that your genes are such that you're an easy keeper. So if you don't do a good job, then we're going to wind up paying the price in terms of excess weight. Okay. So kind of, how long have you been back home now?
I've been home since last summer.
Last summer. So since last summer, it's been in the last 8 months or so, 8 or 9 months, that you lost this 15 pounds?
Well, by October, I had lost 30 pounds, but then my mom was diagnosed, and my eating habits went right out the window. So,
wow.
So then I started eating more. Like, I wasn't really struggling with the cramp circuit at that point, and so I was, like, doing really well. But then when her diagnosis came, I started really cramming.
Okay. So you had gone very quickly from 170 down to about 140?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow. You've got a very dynamic system. So all we needed to do is actually get your diet down in normal ranges for calorie density, and you are very, very quickly restoring order. So that's fabulous. I think right now that as I was just describing it for in the previous issues we were talking about the ego trap, all that motivation is it's a set of relationships about cost benefit. And so for yourself, you know, you're sort of looking at your life and its context and your mom. And it's pretty hard to get too motivated to worry about your own body and your own health habits when your mom is in this enormous fight. Okay?
Right.
So I don't really consider this to be a particularly high priority problem. And I don't think your mind is considering it a very high priority problem. So I think to fight against the pleasure trap requires kind of a workspace in your mind that you've only got, as Dr. Esselstyn says, you've only got so many units of potential units of effort for change. And that's true. And so if we're spending a lot of your psychological units on other things, worrying about someone else, you've got less steam to battle something as oppressive as the pleasure trap. So I'm not the slightest bit worried about you in terms of this long term. And I would just tell you, you know, just go a decent direction, do a decent job on your eating, and this will sort itself out. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
go
you
ahead.
Very much.
Yeah. Did you have a question that I missed?
No, that was everything.
Yeah. Yeah. You just this is not a problem that we need to worry about right now. You're someone that when it is more important for you, I believe that you'll handle it very well. But the one thing that we can do for your mom is to let her know that you're actually safe and that in the long term, you're going to be on a really good course. My pleasure, Nicola.
All right, Nicola, thank you so much for the call. We really, really appreciate it. And for the wonderful question. Yeah. All right, Dr. Lyle, we're going to go to another question from our listeners.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle?
Sure.
Some people, like athletes, students, experience performance anxiety that affects their performance in the area of their endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that under practice conditions, low pressure environment, they perform without any problems. But when under the gun, they start showing a lower performance result. Is there a reason for this type of anxiety from the perspective of evolutionary psychology?
That's a good question. I thought through this thing at one point, and I actually read in a Malcolm Gladwell book. He goes through an explanation. Some people analyze this whole phenomenon of choking, and unfortunately, I can't remember the logic, but it was quite interesting, and it certainly had to do with the process of shifting a process from unconscious to conscious. And this is kind of how I would see the concept of choking. And to move from an unconscious to a conscious process would involve the worrying about what other people are thinking because I'm being watched or somehow recorded. So this is sort of the activation of self-presentational concerns. So I see this as a bizarre manifestation of the ego trap. So you can imagine someone who's expected to make a free throw in a big game, and they are now thinking about that other people are expecting them to make this, and they're not sure that they can make it. And so as a result, the ego trap is activated, and now they're actually procrastinating and fiddling. And now what they do is they try to sort of consciously direct the process because they have to do it. Instead of allowing a unconscious process to just unfold the way they would if they were in practice and not considering being watched. So you can activate the same process in practice if the coach is watching you and says, okay, I'm really going to need to look at your shot now. What's the next five times down the floor? Let's have Jones shoot it. And I really want to look at your form and your footwork. Okay. Now what do? We can activate the same process. So it doesn't have to be in the big game in front of the big crowd. It could be under any sort of scrutiny from an outside party. So I think that this is a sort of a novel problem that is not one consistent in our natural history. And it's particularly, it's sort of a novel manifestation of the ego trap. And I think it's particularly obviously evident in motor skill. So it's not going to happen typically with, you know, on a big test. You know, you got a big math test in calculus and everybody, you know, expects you to do really well and you get in there and you, quote, choke. I don't think so. I don't think you choke then. You might be nervous and a little hard to settle down for a second, but you look at the first problem and you just start logically breaking it down, et cetera. This has to do with motor skills, where motor skills are sort of wrapped little circuits, you know, inside of a well-honed, myelinated
circuits in the motor area. And as a result, if we stop the action and make the person be thinking about what it is that other people are thinking of them, then they start to try to guide the process consciously. And I believe what they do is if they start thinking through the fundamentals, they start consciously directing the action and rather than essentially just letting a circuit fire in a coordinated fashion. So they actually regress in their abilities back to the way that they learned it, as opposed to just allowing a smooth process to fire. Great skills have to do with the coordination of a whole bunch of muscles and the timing pattern of the firing and relaxation of a whole set of muscles throughout the body. So when a basketball player shoots a basketball, there's all kinds of things happening in muscles everywhere. So remember, the feet are pushing against the ground in a certain way, and that energy is being transferred through the legs, the hips, et cetera, the coordination of the upper body, and then, of course, the hands, and then the entire major motor movement. This is super complicated. And so if you and in order to do it well, it's something that took years to wrap myelin sheath to get it to go. If you break that thing down and miscoordinate it, all hell's going to break loose. And that's what choking is. And I don't think choking in that way would have been something that would have happened in human natural history. I think this is it's a great question. But as I'm thinking about this, I believe this is a bizarre modern manifestation of this potentiality of human behavior. You're not going to choke if you're on the African savannah and you've got a spear in your hand and there's a lion coming towards you. Okay, you won't. You're going to be on autopilot and you're going to activate that myelin sheath. However, if there's a game and there's a bunch of pretty girls around and you're the guy that's trying to throw this thing through some kind of a hoop, you may very well, if they expect you to do really well because you've got this big rep, you may very well choke. So it's a little bit different issue as a result of a novel type of a situation.
So survival is more important than reproduction at the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, that's largely going to be the case. That's why when the chips are down, I've managed to survive, but I haven't managed to reproduce. So that's how that works.
Right. Dr. Lai, you're reminding me about this myelin sheath. When I was younger, my parents put me through violin, playing violin. And so the teacher, my very first teacher, was really creative with how she would prepare her students before the concert. And so once you learn the song, then she would have a lesson where you play the song and then she like makes a whole bunch of noise, taps on her stand, the music stand, has some bells and whistles and clicking and dances around, claps all over you so that you can prepare for a concert. So it's interesting that we see that in play.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sort of stress inoculation. A good strategy, and they're doing that in professional athletics now. They're finding ways to do exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. Our next question, Dr. Lyle, I've been listening to your podcasts, and I'm wondering if the ego trap can still come into play when there are no longer societal expectations. For example, I've been retired for 7 years. The retirement was sudden. My organization merged. My job was eliminated. And what I thought would be an opportunity with the new organization turned out to be far less attractive than it originally seemed to be. So in the space of 2 weeks, I decided to retire. My husband was very supportive. He agreed to subsidize some of my lost income so we could maintain our houses and pretty much have no change in lifestyle. Seems like the perfect solution, except that it's not. I'm bored, frustrated, and feel like my only purpose in life is to keep the house, which admittedly I don't do very well because I hate housework and I procrastinate. Fine, you might say, then why don't I go out and do something, get another job, volunteer? But I don't want to do that either. I have no interest in doing it. My husband doesn't really want me to do it, and nothing appeals to me enough to break the inertia. My health is somewhat of an issue now. My stamina is not what it once was, but that's not really what's holding me back. I'm not sure what is holding back. What say you?
Move to Somalia.
Refer to the first question we had, the animal in the zoo.
The animal in the zoo.
That's what it is. So, yeah, I kind of don't feel like working. You know, the new company came in, the job just wasn't that attractive. So, just kind of decided to retire. I mean, it's beautiful, and I'm glad that this lady's circumstances were that good. I'm glad because no, you don't want to work in a job you don't want to do. However, this is the animal in the zoo problem, and the solution is to run an experiment with some kind of part-time job, volunteer work, or learn to crochet, or learn to do bonsai plants, okay, something. The notion here, what we clearly have is a productive activity deficiency, and we're getting the malaise that's associated with the productive activity deficiency. So just because you don't have to work doesn't mean you shouldn't. You're an animal, and as an animal, what you have is you've got a mechanism for determining whether or not you're competent to survive. And you don't. What you want to do is you want to actually test that competence on a routine basis, so that you can update your memory systems, and your memory systems can basically say, well, yes, we can remember. Very recently, you demonstrated your competence. Therefore, you don't have to have any anxiety about the fact that you're not competent. Okay. So if you have not traded in the environment, you haven't actually, carved some soap into an elephant, and somebody bought it from you for $5. If you haven't actually poured somebody a cup of coffee and gotten a tip for it, if you actually haven't done any productive activity for which some non-related, non-nepotistic situation would result in you gaining some goods from the world, then we can expect that your self-efficacy with respect to your ability to survive has actually declined. So, as a result, I would expect that there's a vague sense of not so sure I'm competent, not so sure that I could survive without my husband and my pension, and not so sure that everything is capiche between me and the world. And so this person, there's a little haunting in the system saying, could you really make it? Could you really make it out there in the world? Could you really survive? Do you really, have the chops? And if you can't, if you can't answer that question in the affirmative, of course, it's a probabilistic assessment that you make. So I'm sure that the person believes that they could, but they don't have the certainty that they would have had they just earned a dollar today. So it could be that you've got enough dollars in the bank and you've got enough support, and you actually feel very secure in that regard. But I would still argue that the overall process still results in a sense of productive activity. And that without productive activity, that essentially you feel a malaise that the person is experiencing. So whatever it is that you do, whatever it is that it might be, it should be something that to you feels productive. And if you look at the world and say, gee, there's just nothing that I can see in the world that would feel productive, then you're a person that needs to be threatened. Okay, so you need to find out whether or not you would be accepted into a coalition for your ability to produce, and see whether or not you could do it. And I'm going to assume that if this person does something that's productive, and some other human being says, "Hey, that looks good," so you go out in your yard and you plant a row of roses, and somebody looks at it and says, "Hey, that looks nice." Your Stone Age brain will say, you know what? That means that if I were to do that in somebody else's garden, somebody might pay me $20 to do it. So you have effectively increased your own assessment of your ability to survive,
just by making your own garden more beautiful. So there's an infinite amount of things to do in the world. Some of those things have to do with soaking in the natural beauty of the planet. Some of them have to do with looking at other people's achievements and enjoying those. But another thing has to do with us producing achievements that other people find useful or attractive in some way. We are both producers and we are consumers. And this person sounds like they are definitely young enough that they could still be a producer, and therefore they should be. One of the sadder things that you will see is in older people, like my mother, who's now 86 and has significant Alzheimer's. She's still with us enough that her personality is still there and she can still think and contribute to a conversation. But there is very significant memory deficit, so I have to take care of all kinds of things that my mother 10 years ago was fully capable of doing. And she feels it. She feels the lack of ability to contribute. And it's a significant source of depression and anxiety in her existence. And so she wishes, I would say at least 100 times in the last 3 years, I have heard her say, what I need to do is to get a job. And the very sad reality is she cannot get a job because nobody would hire her because there's nothing that she can do that she's competent to trade for. Okay. So this little creature now is in fact dependent, and she feels the lack of productive activity. She'll get up and clean her kitchen floor and do some things and do her laundry. And when she does that, that activates that feeling of productive activity and she feels better. Okay. But she would like very much to do something that another individual would say, hey, that's valuable. That looks really good. And so to yield the floor to that experience, behind the animal in a zoo trap, I would say that that's a dangerous waste of life, and that what this person needs to do is to look themselves in the mirror and realize, hey, you know, there's exactly one person that's stopping you from engaging in productive activity, and that's you. Your job is to go out and figure out how to do something, try it. If it's no fun and you don't get any kick out of it, try something else. And keep doing it until you trip upon some problem or some group of people that give you a response to your efforts that makes it worthwhile.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lyle, we got time for one more question, or you want to do two more?
One more.
One more. Okay, we're going to scroll down all the way to the very last question.
Mm-hmm.
It's about your method of getting someone out of an ego trap. Okay, Dr. Lyle, your method of getting someone out of an ego trap is incredibly effective. As a previous caller on the show mentioned about his son now doing better in school now that his father lowered his expectations. However, as I've seen, it requires some tact not to damage the relationship. For example, I got my girlfriend, now my ex-girlfriend, out of a deep ego trap, but I damaged our relationship in the process. Partially responsible for getting her into the deep ego trap because I kept telling her that she could complete this extremely difficult project and that she was very capable of. And to undo this ego trap, I said, I don't think this kind of thing is cut out for you. And if I had to bet for or against you to complete the project, I'd bet against you. So she got out of it very quickly, but she was bitter towards me afterwards. She brought up what I had said during one of our arguments. I know that our relationship now is unsalvageable, but I don't want to make the same mistake with the new relationship. Can you go into detail about this method and how to avoid damaging the relationship?
Wow. Nate, did you write this?
No, but I've had a similar situation where I was trying to get a friend out of the ego trap and ended up insulting them. So this question was very dear to me.
Let me think about this. Yeah. Sometimes when I present this, sometimes I'm a little bit in a hurry and I don't maybe go over these issues in detail. And I kind of expect people to have possible social sensitivity and tact that they may not possess, or that they may you know, put on hold while they execute my sort of entertaining sounding program. So let me clarify this, at least for our little corner of the world. And that is, yes, it does require tact, and that's why it's better off done, you know, in a face-to-face way where you can watch the impact of your lowering expectations on the individual. So it's possible that when you lower the expectations and say, I'm not so sure that, you know, maybe you can't do it. If you watch them and they feel crestfallen, if it actually takes the wind out of their sails, then you realize, they were looking to me to estimate their statistical likelihood of success, and now I've actually lowered their self-efficacy. That is possible, okay? That's what everybody thinks is going to happen and almost never does, but it might. And so I'm looking for that, okay? What I'm looking for when I lower the expectations is the anger and the irritation, which is what this guy found. So he lowered the expectations, and it worked. So the anger and the irritation, the person basically felt like, hey, you're underestimating me, I'll show you, which is the classic ego trap response. Now, the truth is we can usually get the anti-ego trap response. We can get a person out of the ego trap by just being playful with how it is that we do it. So we can have a twinkle in our eye and kind of a smile, like, I'm not so sure you can do this, okay? Maybe you can't, okay? If we do that, it's irritating, but it's not the same thing as the hard sell. And the person is getting a message, and the message is that we don't in any way think less of them because we're not sure that they can do it, and that we actually think that they might be able to do it, but they might not do it, and we would consider it a little bit humorous if they couldn't do it, okay? And no status loss to them at all if they can't. So this is this is what I will do with my clients, with adult clients, and with I don't see kids anymore, but kids I could do it that way too. So you could tell a kid, I don't think you could go off that diving board. It's too high for you. I'm pretty sure you can't. Maybe you could. Maybe. Okay. And you can be playful with them, and they can watch your face, and they can see, they can be a little confused. But they can feel the irritation of, I'll show you. They can sniff that if they do it, they're going to get to gloat. And they can also sniff that you think that they might be able to do it, so that they can infer that this is probably within their abilities, and all they have to do is do it. So that's the more sophisticated version. Now, would there be a time and a place to actually to give the hard sell like this guy did? Yeah, there might be. And where you just say, I don't think so. Yeah, mostly there's an important caveat whenever I sell hard on the downside. And that my attitude is, hey, but you know, maybe you can, maybe you can't. No, I think there's a good chance that you can't, but that's fine. We'll find out. You know, we'll learn by making an effort. What do we have to lose? And so the additional part of the sales job is, I'm still with you all the way, and I don't think any less of you if you make the effort and you fail. And so, you know, we might as well make the effort. Maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't. You'll have to decide for yourself, but I don't see any reason not to give it a shot and see what happens. But I think there's a good chance it won't work, but hey, it might. So it's really, what we're doing is we're speaking right to the source code, because this is exactly what they're thinking. If they really didn't think that they had a chance to succeed, they would have no motivation to do it. They have some motivation to pursue it, but they're tortured by the fact that the expectations are too high, that they perceive that the world already gives them credit for having the abilities to accomplish whatever it is. And so now they're in a trap. As they run the CB, there's just not enough upside. So the most elegant place to put the anti-ego trap cell is right in the middle. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. Okay? And if you can, that'd be great. It'd be a great outcome, but I don't really expect it. And so I think there's a good chance that you can't. There's a lot of factors that are in the way that we're not in control of, and it's difficult what it is that you're up to. So maybe it doesn't work, okay? And that's fine, no problem, but we'll learn something in the effort. So that's the way to handle the ego trap in a way that like I said, this part of this is my fault. So, you know, I can tell this story in a short story where I sell hard on the downside and I fire up a tremendous motivation to prove me wrong. And that can be a beautiful thing. So in this case, obviously, you know, maybe it's a good thing that she's an ex because you obviously, the person did something elegant and very, very clever and useful and essentially unleashed a motivation that was very useful for the target person. And then obviously we're talking it, you know, talking in the future about why we did what we did. And would the person feel manipulated? Maybe. But they would also see that they got tremendous benefit and they learned something super useful about themselves and about people in the process. And if they didn't appreciate that and appreciate that we were doing it for their own best interest and they're all bent out of shape indefinitely about it, hey, I don't, you know, maybe it's a good that it's an X. A great, you know, ego trap trick that is done and has been done in recording studios for decades is to tell the band that, you know, just you guys just riff around for a while and we'll roll tape in a little while. And then you roll tape the whole time. And so by being out of the ego trap, they are playing loose and they're just going with the groove, and they sometimes manufacture fantastic stuff as a result of that. They relax. And then you tell them later, hey, guess what? We rolled tape on that. Are they upset that we lied to them? No. They're like, thank God. That was some of the best stuff we've ever done. It's like, yeah, we got it. Okay. So, you know, properly done, properly delivered, properly explained. This shouldn't be a problem and I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyle, we'll make sure not to roll any tape when we're talking, but maybe. Get some hot mic in there.
All right.
Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. Oh, this is great. We explained the ego trap in two episodes. If listeners have some more questions, always welcome to call in or write in, and we'll take more of these questions next show. Not necessarily about the ego trap, but about the upcoming, but the most recent questions as well. So, Dr. Lyle, as always, thank you very much for coming on. We'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Very good. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.